Thanks for listening to the Scottish Housing Podcast. You can find out more about the presenters by going to scottishhousingpod.com, and you can also follow us on social media. We are on Instagram, Twitter, TikTok and Facebook. Just look up at Scottish Housing Pod.
The Scottish Housing Podcast is brought to you in partnership with Indigo Square, 2010 Consultancy, and the Right Business Center.
Anybody who knows me and has heard me talk about property before will know that I love housing stats, particularly counterintuitive housing stats.
Yeah, as long as you source them.
So do you want to introduce yourself as our guest today?
Yeah, I'm John Boyle, so I'm Director of Research and Strategy at Retties, based in Edinburgh, but cover the whole Scottish market. And I fell into property really about 20 years ago. So I was working in a consultancy that got bought by a big property firm called DTZ. Mm-hmm. And then I was an economist. So I had to kind of reinvent myself as a property economist. And then I thought, well, I need to be in the whole hog now, if I'm in property. So then I trained as a chartered surveyor and qualified as a chartered surveyor. So I moved to Retties about, 12 years ago. So specialised really in the residential market in Scotland. So do a lot of kind of advisory and consultancy work for the house builders, but increasingly in the build to rent sector, until the build to rent sector got kind of cut off at the knees. We might talk about that later. But also advise RSLs and do a bit of work for government on policy reviews, stuff like that.
So it is really interesting having an estate agent's having a sort of an analytical data department. I've worked through a state agency for nearly 30 years. And I think Retty must be the only sort of high street estate agents who's got that set up.
Savills have got a research team as well, headed up by Faisal Chowdhury, who I know and get on with well, and frequently swap notes on things just to make sure that we're on the kind of the right page, or we're pulling the evidence together. We believe in kind of sharing information and evidence wherever we can in order just to get the market in the right place or to inform our customer base as best as we can. So they do it. But there isn't that much in Scotland. You find the most of the research teams tend to be down south. So, you know, your Knight Franks and Strutton Parkers and these kind of other big agents. They tend to have their teams down south, you know, in the London market and covering. They do cover Scotland, but they put a Scottish badge on it, but really a lot of the work is down.
The reason I used to hate when I worked for corporates was, we'll tartanise it, which I always thought was a bit like, they're going to stick a See You Jimmy hat on it.
But I think the power of what you do, John, and your equivalent at Savills is that it's evidence-based.
Yeah.
And from those of us that still kind of in a way inhabit the political world, the interesting thing is how, for example, planning has developed, NPF4 and how local development plans are to emerge around evidence-based policy making, which to many people in politics, regardless of party, is a bit of anathema because it's about, you know, traditionally, politics is a bit instinctive and it's about emotion, it's about where you sit in the spectrum, but everything you do and contribute to the wider property industry and as a result of it being so evidence-based to the wider conversation in Scotland actually should make you a very significant player in influencing public policy. And I'm not sure that all of our politicians or those that serve politicians, advisors, civil service officials, always, I've been consistent about evidence approach to everything. So you reference, for example, the PRS market, and I will wander on to some of this over conversation. But I'd just like to put that marker down about, if we're going to have evidence-based policy making, then let's make sure we source the best evidence. And that's why I'm particularly interested to be part of this conversation this morning.
Yeah, I mean, because obviously there's the headline stats that come out of places like the Register of Scotland.
Yeah.
And I think traditionally that's what grabs the headlines. Average house price has done X, but you used a word in your description of what you do, which is really important, and you talked about research. And for me, it's what you do is more important than just pulling out the headline stats, because anybody can, it's what the headline stats are then telling you. And I suppose that's where being an economist comes in, that what you're looking at is not just, well, the figures say X, but it's why did the figure say X and what's the consequences of a figure saying X? And I suppose that's why, you know, I love what you do, because it's the whys around the facts that matter. So tell us, you said just before you started, you've just given a conference, so the stats are all at the front of your head. Tell us some really, really, really interesting facts about the Scottish housing market that then, or property, residential property in Scotland in general, that you think then give real pointers that, as Stephen says, politicians should be picking up on.
Yeah, I mean, I was presenting at the NHBC conference this morning, and one of the questions I got was, how come house prices have stabilised, but rents are still going up, you know, quite markedly as they are in Scotland? So, been double digits in the main cities for, you know, the past couple of years. Whereas house prices, yeah, I mean, house price growth over 2023, according to registers, was 0.8%. So very modest, but it didn't tank.
Yeah.
As, you know, some experts had anticipated at the end of 2022. We weren't on that page. We thought there would be a moderate slowdown, but actually, you know, prices stabilised.
Yeah. And the, well, 0.8% is effectively a flat line.
It's a flat line, yeah. It's fairly, I mean, if you want to, if it's glass half empty, you're thinking stagnant. If it's glass half full, you're thinking stable or consolidated.
Yeah.
So the answer to that question really is, it's to do with the demand supply dynamics within the market. So it's the case with both supply in the for sales market and the supply in the rental market has actually been quite consistent. You know, if you trend it back to 2020 or 2021, you know, just after the pandemic, you'll find that supply, new property coming onto the market, has been broadly stable in both the rental market and in the sales market. What happened in both markets after 2021 is you had the post-pandemic boom, and that meant that demand escalated well ahead of supply. So that led to price growth, because you had too many people chasing too few properties in both the sales and the rental market. What's happened over 2023 is a lot of demand came out of the sales market because of what happened with mortgages, and people just couldn't afford to move, or they just put off the kind of the house purchasing decision. Also, the new build market suffered because not just of those demand drivers, but also construction cost inflation, supply chain effects, you know, new regulations. So the supply actually in the new build sector dwindled. But what happened over 2023 is that those kind of two lines, you know, if you index it from 2021, is the two lines then met by the time you get into 2023. So the market's in much more of a kind of an equilibrium type state, which is why house prices have consolidated. In the rental market, though, that gap has stayed there. So the demand drivers haven't come out of the rental market in the same way that they have done in the sales market. In fact, with the increased cost of mortgages, that's driven more people into the rental market because it's made it more difficult for them to get lending for a new home, or to remortgage, or to pay a deposit, you know, on a new property. So that's meant that you've got more people, particularly more younger people, in the rental market, and the supply has not responded. The rental market used to be quite responsive, but because of a lot of the political noise, the supply hasn't responded. You know, in the BTR sector, as Stephen highlighted earlier, that's now, it's embryonic in Scotland, but it's not really grown. And so that demand-supply imbalance is what's driven advertised rents. So rents on newly let properties is still up, you know, 10% plus in Edinburgh and Glasgow. And that doesn't really look like it's going to change. And if, you know, the government brings in rent controls, it's brought in rent controls within tenancies, but not between tenancies. But if it brings them in, as it's speculated in the new housing bill, if it brings in the rent controls between the tenancies, then, you know, the economic concept of scarcity has to find a way of getting out. And if it can't do it through price inflation, it'll do it through queues.
Can I jump back to a very quick question before we move on to the really interesting topic of what's going on in the rental market? When you talk about the lines in 2023 coming together, like reaching an equilibrium, Do you think that gives evidence that the Bank of England's monetary policy, particularly around interest rates, has been correct and is beginning to bear fruit?
Yeah, I think that's probably a fair comment. But I think they started the increase in the rates too late. So the market kind of got a bit overheated and the economy got a bit overheated. And Liz Truss and Kwasi Kwarteng get blamed for a lot of things. And the problem there was that they gave a budget that just wasn't credible and the markets didn't believe it. And then interest rates hiked up, you know, overnight. Whereas if the bank had had a, you know, a more gradual approach to raising those rates from about early 2022, hindsight is a great thing, but, you know, late 21 or early 2022, Bank of England, as I think many of the, you know, senior peer personnel within the bank would now admit, they should have been moving interest rates kind of gradually over that time. And that could have brought the market a bit more into equilibrium a bit sooner. But, you know, the response, you know, there is a demand response where you try and reduce the demand, but then there's a problem with that because that demand comes from somewhere, you know. So the demand comes from, you know, people needing a home or needing a bigger home, or because life stage fact drivers, you know, mean I need a family home. My two-bed flat is no longer big enough when I've got two kids, so I need to get a three- or four-bedroom property. So you've got those life stage drivers anyway for demand. What you need to do is you need to have a supply response as well when demand is driving up, as it has been in Scotland. But we haven't really had the supply response, all kinds of reasons. But we have don't have a good distribution of property. So we've got, you know, some people over occupying property and some people under occupying property. There isn't really the the carrots and sticks within the tax system to make people leave properties that are now under occupying. You know, you're thinking of, you know, a person living on the road still rattling around in a 5-bedroom house. You know, if you, for example, had no LBTT or stamp duty on your last purchase, would that incentivise those people then to, you know, leave those properties and free up the properties for families? And then the new build industry also hasn't really, you know, kicked on and responded to the increase in demand for new housing. And that's part due to a capacity issue because we're very dependent on a small number of volume house builders, and the SMEs kind of have been frozen out of the market. Many of the SMEs have been frozen out of the market since 2008-9. Found it very difficult to get back in. Mm-hmm. Quite high barriers to entry. But it's also, in my opinion anyway, it's to do with a planning system that's still, you know, quite conservative, bureaucratic, reactionary. It's not really proactive. And it's not really about driving delivery. In the way that it probably should, and the way that it probably used to. You think in the 50s and the 60s, when planning was very close related to economic development, we got the new towns and we managed to clear the slums. And, you know, that was a kind of a plan, very proactive, public interest-led planning approach. And we've moved away from that, where planning now tends to be, you know, quite a small part of local government, not very well funded, and is quite reactionary and bureaucratic. And I don't think NPN4 or the new planning framework is really going to help matters in that regard. I don't see anything in there that really is going to enhance delivery.
There's so many strands to what you said there. I've got 101 questions. So first one's a very quick one, which is not housing related. It's more political related, right? It's just something you said about Liz Truss and Kwasi Kwarteng behaving in one way, and very simple. The Bank of England was made independent by Gordon Brown. I remember growing up. In fact, I always remember not long after starting the state agency, there was a guy from Switzerland came in and he'd done all his research and he'd worked out that there was about to be an election and interest rates were always pushed down by the Chancellor prior to the election. And then they would have to be whacked up straight after a general election. And he'd worked out that there was a general election looming, so interest rates were at a low point. And he went and so he was doing all this stuff. And of course, what then happened was Labour won that election. An economic boom sort of came from the work that had been happening, and interest rates didn't go back up. But does an independent bank, central bank, work? This is more my ignorance of economics and politics slightly. Does an independent bank work when we are all living in the political middle ground? And when you've got more extreme political positions, does it not work? Because what you've got is the politicians working an economic policy that's way over here, and the Bank of England treading the middle ground, this is what we always do, principle. Is there an issue? Do you think there is an issue?
Yeah, I mean, the Bank of England, or the monetary policy...
Would it have been better for Truss and Kwatang if they also had the levers of control of the Bank of England at the same time they're doing the budget?
God. The way things worked out, probably not. But, I mean, it's worth bearing in mind that the Bank of England Monetary Policy Committee is independent with a small I, you know, so... the governor's a political appointment, the MPC members are political appointments. It's not quite like the Supreme Court, where you kind of put in people of your own ideological persuasion. You know, in the state.
Is it more like the US Supreme Court?
Yes, that's what I'm getting at, yeah. Not the UK Supreme Court, but where you put people in of your own kind of ideological persuasion. It doesn't work that way, and there's a kind of a rotation of the MPC members as well. So you don't have people, you know, serving there for like 40 years, whatever, or need to die before they can be replaced. But the positive thing is it took that element of political, overtly naked political control out of it. And it meant that the Bank of England had a clear remit, which was to, you know, provide economic stability. And its economic stability, or the version of economic stability, is to keep inflation at around about 2%, which, you know, I think most people or most economists would agree is a sensible level. You know, a little bit of inflation does you good. You don't want to be in a deflationary world because people stop purchasing things. You know, Japan had that for the best part of a decade. But then you don't want to have a hyperinflationary world, as we've just come out of, because that creates lots of uncertainty. And then, you know, wage expectations start going up and you can start getting a spiral, and then you've got no real way to pay for it unless you start increasing taxes or borrowing, and that all needs to be paid for. So what you want, what you don't want to happen is to have a deflationary world or an inflationary world, and you want to have relatively stable monetary policy. And by taking it away from the politicians, it stopped that kind of general electioneering thing of you bring it down when before an election, then have to ramp it straight back up, you know, after election, which creates political instability. At least by hiving it off to the Bank of England Monetary Policy Committee, independent with a small I, you task a group of experts to try and give you that economic stability or that platform that you can then build on, or the politicians can build an economy on.
And with housing being such a significant part of our economy, I suppose that's where some of your latest analyses around stats that you've been referring to earlier and talking about earlier this morning are really interesting. I wonder if, particularly picking up around the PRS sector, because it's in relation to the evidence of rising rent costs as opposed to the equilibrium that is in the private for sale market. I wonder, with macroeconomic policy one end of the spectrum and all of that around inflation, and over the other spectrum, a very politically flux country that we've been for the last decade, you know, Brexit just one example, a looming general election, and the establishment party of the country, the current party of government, being in a kind of state of flux for a whole number of reasons. Over here, we have a very hot debate with the Scottish Government about both its taxation policy and its housing policy, what you've referenced about the rental market. And we now have local authorities in Scotland, our two biggest cities, in fact, declaring a housing emergency. Now, to me, I don't actually understand what declaring a housing emergency means, but to me, an emergency means all-encompassing. Mm-hmm. So I've heard it said by others that there's actually an emergency in every sector.
Yeah.
And if that is the case, what are the stats telling us about how acute it is in each sector, and how do we get a conversation that everyone can relate to in each sector, and all these other big players like macroeconomic policy, Scottish Government, the industry, etc., to find that magic equilibrium that if there's an emergency and it's all-encompassing, it's every sector, how does the evidence and your stats tell us anything about how we find the solution in each sector?
Yeah.
Presumably they help each other.
Yeah, absolutely. And we did a bit of work for Homes of Scotland a few years ago. So there have been various commissions and close examinations of the housing market that's in Scotland that's been done, you know, over the last 10 to 15 years. So there was a report by Commission for Housing and Wellbeing, which was kind of a shelter forum, but it involved private and public sector representatives. It was chaired by Robert Black, who was a former Auditor General for Scotland, and it came up with a figure of around about 25,000 new housing units per year would be required. And that was back in, whenever they produced the report, it was around about 2012, 2013, something like that. We updated that report, piece of work for Homes for Scotland, and we also came out with the 25,000 figure as a kind of a medium-term target, as you should be building each year in order to keep yourself in something like, you know, equilibrium, or at least to be able to meet the demand, or the rise in demand that we're seeing in Scotland. Then there was a piece of work that Professor Glenn Bramley from Heriot-Watt University, very respected, you know, academic, and who's written, you know, advised on Scottish Government policy over many years, and he produced a piece of work for Crisis in the National Housing Federation back in 2013, which did something similar, looking at need on a very kind of holistic basis. And he also came up with a figure of around about 27,000 over 13 years. Well, we updated it, 27,000 over 13 years. So both of those figures, if you use those methodologies, slightly different methodologies, but they both come around about the same level of around about, you know, 25 to 27,000 a year. Now, we haven't built at that level since 2007. Was all tenure. You know, that was the last year in which we hit the 25,000 target. Some years we've been way below that, you know, just after the global financial crisis, when we're barely at 50% of that figure.
You said 2007.
2007.
A year before
the crash, yeah. And the time before that, before we, when we last built at 25,000, do you want to have a guess?
Was it? I'm going to pick some ridiculous figure of pre-1980.
Yeah.
In like the 60s or something.
Yeah, 78.
Right.
So 78, just before the Thatcher government came out. And the bulk of that was public housing.
Social housing.
Yeah, I was going to say pre-1980 because it's social housing that's going to have done it.
Yeah. But it had been declared. We peaked at around about, I think, 55,000 houses around about 1970. And, you know, that was obviously the post-war housing boom, which lasted about 25 years, and most of it was public sector. And then the private public sector, you know, gradually, I mean, it never went away altogether. You still had the RSLs, so they were building at around about, and some councils building at around about 4,000, 5,000 units a year, and we've maintained that. In fact, that's increased a little bit because under the current administration, social house building, at least until very recently when the budget was slashed, was given a higher level of priority. So actually social housing completions have come up over the last 10 to 15 years. But private sector delivery, for the reasons I mentioned earlier, small and medium-sized companies basically exiting the sector.
Yeah.
And the problems that you've had in finding land and, you know, for speculative private sector building. Private sector delivery is not good. Anywhere near where it was back 2007. We were kind of, just after the pandemic, beginning to ramp back up again. You know, we were getting over, we're comfortably over 20,000 units per year. But this year, the approvals are down again because of the problems within the private sector due to increasing costs, supply chain issues, planning, but also problems within the affordable sector, also affected by increasing costs, increasing regulations, and, you know, trying to get the workforce into certain places.
When you mentioned that stat about pre-1980 and you think of the ageing population we have today, that in itself tells you why we would have a housing crisis of some form today.
The Scottish Housing Podcast is brought to you by the Wright Business Centre. Located just off the M8 in Glasgow, we have office space to suit all companies from the smallest startup to a large corporate business. Wright Business Centre also provides virtual office services like mail handling, creating a seamless virtual operation for remote teams or startups. Whatever your business needs, go to wrightbusinesscentre.co.uk.
You mentioned the cut in this year's Scottish budget around the affordable housing budget. And if I've detected correctly what's being said, there's been a heavy hint that more of the, what is left in that budget will be channelled towards direct acquisition, which the Scottish Government's been doing, mainly with its underspends, I understand, the last couple of years with the affordable housing budget. And they're picking up on what some of the big RSLs, like the Wheatley Group, have been doing for some years now. Do you have any evidence or stats to say what impact that's having in other sectors, that big RSLs, or now the Scottish Government, can just come in and directly buy things out of the private sector market and bring them into the social sector?
Yeah, the principle of it isn't wrong, you know, particularly if you're taking property that's maybe been empty for, you know, for a long time and bringing it into the affordable sector. The principle of that's not wrong. The problem though with it is that it doesn't really add to the housing numbers, you know, so it changes the tenure, but it doesn't really add to the housing numbers. Also, the fund is about, or the new acquisition fund, I think, was around about 60 million. Which sounds a lot of money, but then, you know, you're looking at the average build cost of, what is it now, 200 grand all in. So £1 million is going to get you 5 houses, £60 million is going to get you 300 houses, you know. So it's all welcome, but in that, you know, deficit that we've just kind of talked about there of, what is it, possibly 100,000 houses over the last 15, 20 years, because we've been behind target. You know, that 300 is pretty much a drop in the ocean.
I remember speaking to someone from a housing association about the ability of them to get about £6 million from something. And I remember him saying, Principal, you just said there, I've got 5,000 people on my waiting list. If I get £6 million, I build 30 houses.
Yeah.
I've still got 5,000 people on my waiting list.
Yeah, exactly.
Because it's a drop in the ocean. A couple of things, because one of the things that, you know, whenever I'm talking to people about we need to build and I borrow, your stats of 25 and 27,000 properties a year, and how for a good period after 2008 we were at half that level in both combined and private and public sector. So it just creates a cumulative.
Yeah.
But people then, so I suppose I've got two questions here in one. People will often say, but our population's pretty static. How can we be needing to build 25,000 properties a year, every year, for 10, 20 years? So that's one question. But I suppose it then feeds into the other thing you've mentioned about the small to medium builders. I mean, I, pre-2008, did you know, run Land and New Homes for a big estate agents, and it was all small to medium builders that were built with sites of 10 to 50 houses on their properties. And they've gone, as you've said, but they were in tertiary locations. They were not in the prime locations because the land was cheaper in those. And I suppose the other question is, I mean, I was on a thing last year. It was a French TV programme with property people from throughout Europe talking about rent rises in all the major cities across Europe. And the general theme of that was the economies of the world, of Europe, are now centred around the big urban conurbations. So is part of the problem all the jobs are in the one place, so all the land needs to be in the one place, so all the houses need to be in the one base. So is part of the problem of our 25,000 houses actually because it's where we need to build the houses? It's part of the problem because we have chunks of massive empty land in Scotland and we don't have economies there for people to go to? Is it a mix of all of those?
No, I mean, these are all good points.
And sorry, and so the other thing is, explain, why do we need 25,000 or 27,000 houses a year when our population's static?
Yeah, I mean, I'll deal with that one first of all. when you say population stagnant, Scotland did have a fairly stagnant population between about 1920. Getting into the stats here, and 2004. So we tended to stick at around about the 5 million level. Now, the components of the population changed, but the overall total didn't. So we used to be very good at making babies. So the fertility rate was high in Scotland, even up until, you know, the late 1960s, very high. But then we tend to lose them when they became adults. So the net migration to other parts of the UK and internationally was significant. You know, a lot of Scots just left the country, you know, when they got into the late teens or the early 20s. Usually they look for employment. That kind of changed from around about 2004. And there's various drivers behind it. But the population of Scotland then over a few years went from that 5 million to 5.5 million. So, you know, Scotland was one of the countries or one of the parts of Europe which didn't really have the population expansion after the war, but we got it in 2004. Now, some of that, and there's been various demographic studies that have looked into it, but a good proportion of it was we stopped being a net exporter to people from other parts of the UK and we started being a net importer. So people started coming into Scotland. You know, it's the rise of Glasgow and Edinburgh as, you know, financial centres certainly helped that, plus, you know, rise of other sectors like tech and so on. We also started importing people from other parts of the world, particularly Europe. So in 2004, the AA countries joined, mm-hmm. you know, the Accession 8 countries. So that included countries like Poland, Estonia and Hungary, where there's traditionally quite strong ties with Scotland. So Scotland began to start importing, you know, sizable numbers of those migrants also into the country. So that caused the population to rise quite sharply. And household growth was even faster than population growth, because what we've seen over time is declining average household size, which, you know, a few decades ago was up at, you know, 2.5, maybe close to 3, and now is 2 or under 2.
Right.
So even though the population is stagnant, it was stagnant for a while, but it has grown over the last 20 years. Again, it's kind of stagnated for a number of years over that 5.5 million, but that's a considerable rise where it was back in 2000, pre-2004. But household growth has continued to rise. And that's what's created the demand for housing. And a lot of people...
Four people used to live in one house. Now you need three houses because each house has got 1.5 persons in it, type thing. Yeah.
That kind of thing. And also the housing need has continued to rise, partly because of, as I mentioned earlier, that distribution effect. So you have single people occupying 5-bedroom houses, but you've also got, you know, families of 4 and 5 occupying 2-bedroom houses. Mm-hmm. So they need, their requirements or their needs is for a bigger house. And that also is what drives the need and demand for housing. So we undertook a piece of work for Homes for Scotland again, about 6 months ago, so the results have started, you know, being published. But we conducted a very extensive, so we worked with Mark Diffley, Diffley Partnership, and we conducted a very extensive survey of all households in Scotland. So we had a sample of 14,000. And the results that came back from that was that nearly 700,000 households in Scotland are in some form of acute need.
I remember seeing that. That was out just a couple of weeks ago, wasn't it?
Yeah. And we've got, you know, the surveys are also at a local authority level, so they will be reporting on soon as well. We've got enough of a sample to do, I think, for about 26 of the local authorities. But the bulk of that's concealed households. So that's people like young people, you know, staying with their parents that want to move out but feel that they can't. Or it might be, you know, friends all living together, you know, after student days and they're now young professionals, but they're continuing to, you know, share a property or share a flat, even though they would prefer to have their own house. There's about 200,000 people in unfit properties. So that's, you know, something seriously wrong, you know, with the roof or internal or external walls. There's another 200,000 people living in overcrowded properties. That's not enough bedrooms for all the people in the property. And there's around about or just over 200,000 people living in homes that where they need specialised adaptation or support but don't have them. So, you know, that's homes where they need stair lifts or they now need widened door access because they're, you know, where they're wheelchair users. So that there is a very significant level of need which fuels that demand for new housing. Now, a lot of that is going to be requirement for affordable housing. And you can see that from the waiting list, which is now around about, I don't know, 250,000 or something in Scotland. But there's also a demand for private sector or all tenure housing. because a lot of people don't qualify for social rented housing, or they'll be well down a waiting list if they try to get on a social rented waiting list. What they want is they want good quality private accommodation or first-time buyer accommodation or family housing. And we've got a shortage of all of these things really across Scotland, and that's been the driver behind house price growth over the best part of, you know, 3 decades.
So from everything you said there, one of the things, the makeup of our population is out of kilter with the makeup of our housing stock.
Mm-hmm.
It's part of the challenge. So unless we have a Marshall Plan come in with a post-war attitude of we're going to bulldoze the stuff that doesn't work and have a brand new, we're going to build Xanadu over the hill, we're going to need a massive input from the private sector to do that. Now, you touched on build to rent, and lots of people listen to this might, if you're not within the industry, you might not be familiar with that sector of the market, which, as you said, is just new to Scotland, that is then more or less out. I mean, everything you're telling me is saying that, you know, if you look at the statistics, we've been roughly 60% homeowner occupied now for pretty much 20, 30 years. So that's our level if we are there. And if the rents are going, my basic economics are, if you've got one sector of the market owner occupying that's just flatlined at 60%, give or take, for 20, 30 years, and you've got the other sector, which is the rental market, which has got exponential growth, somehow, public and private, we need to be building lots and lots of property for rent.
Yeah.
Is that very simplistically what needs to happen, and how do we do it?
Yeah, I mean, it is, I think, a big part of what we need to do, because if you can get the institutional funds, I'm talking about, like, about the pension funds and stuff, into the game, they can fund and they can build quickly. So, you know, with your kind of standard house builder will develop a site and will sell out at a rate of sales. So they'll typically aim for, I don't know, about 3 or 4 units a month. And it'll be mortgage dependent. So the pace of delivery is therefore affected by that. If you're a build to rent funder, it goes up and you need to get it occupied pretty quickly.
Mm-hmm.
So you're talking here about, you know, several hundred units that can be built and occupied, you know, within a relatively short period of time. And that can provide that supply into the rental market, which currently is not responding to the sharp increases in demand. And the reason for that is probably partly taxation and it's partly legislative change. So the rental sector used to be quite responsive, but what it did was it was cannibalising stuff from the social rented sector and from the owner occupier sector. So people were taking their, you know, typically flatted accommodation and turning it into PRS accommodation, private rented sector accommodation. Maybe you inherited it, you know, when one of your parents died and you think, well, I've got my house and I'm just going to rent this one out and I'm going to take a yield off it. Or maybe you just had a bit of money and you thought, well, you know, instead of going for a bigger property, I'm actually going to buy a flat in the town, maybe use it occasionally and then rent it out as a short-term rent for a yield. So people saw the opportunities within the market, which is, you know, which is what fueled their eyes in the PRS. So it went up from about 5% of Scottish households back in 2020 to, you know, about 17% now, but it has flatlined in recent years. But what stopped that growth in the PRS is the mortgage changes. So you can no longer claim mortgage tax relief as you could pre-2015. So if you were quite highly leveraged, you know, that could put you underwater quite quickly. So a number of landlords left the sector. Then we had the Scottish Private Residential Tenancies Bill, which got enacted in late 2016. And that kind of tipped the balance, many would say, including us. You know, I mean, we're renting agents, but, you know, we regard ourselves as having tenants and landlords as clients. And many of the changes, you know, were welcomed, you know, by the industry, certainly welcomed by tenants groups, where you could have, you know, long-term tenancies and indefinite tenancies, which really was the main principle behind that new legislation, and the end of what they call no-fault evictions, you know, where landlords could just leave at the end of your 6-month contract and they take the property back. then the landlord needed strong mandatory or discretionary grounds in order to take the property back. But there were some other parts of that bill that for some landlords were quite difficult, you know, to manage around. And that one of them was the 28-day notice period. So effectively, you're a tenant. You could say, well, I want to leave. Many of them did it during the pandemic and hand in the keys, and you've only got 28 days. You know, the 3-year or 5-year lease, that was, you know, that was in the past. And for some landlords, they couldn't really cope with that legislative change. And then in came the rent caps or the rent freeze, and then the rent caps, and then the direction or the future direction of travel for the Scottish Government and the housing bill is to push it even more towards improving the rights for the tenants and not really properly taking account of the viability of the accommodation for the landlords. So for a number of landlords, by no means all, and I don't think we've got a flood of landlords leaving the sector, but we've had more than a trickle. Mm-hmm. You know, and we manage around about 2,000 properties, around, mainly around the central belt in Scotland. And we have noticed, you know, some landlords have decided just to sell up, cash in the chips, put the money somewhere else. The sales market's quite strong. Mm-hmm. So you can, this is not probably not a bad time to cash in. But most others are deciding to go on with it. But what's not happened is that the PRS hasn't responded in the way that it has done before to that kind of sharp increase in demand that I was talking about earlier. So the way to try and solve the question, solve the problem, is to bring the BTR sector into the market, get the institutional funds who are willing to come into Scotland. The fundamentals in Scotland are very high, very strong. So Colliers did a report a few months ago which said Glasgow and Edinburgh, in terms of the demand fundamentals underpinning residential investment, should be number one and two in the country. But if you go look at BTR delivery across all local authorities in the UK, Glasgow is down in something like 72nd and Edinburgh is 86th. So we've not, the sector is very embryonic, and the main barrier, I think, you know, institutional funds would tell you, and, you know, we speak to them often and we're trying to facilitate meetings between them and government. The main barrier is political risk, because they don't know where the government's going with its rent control and other aspects of the housing bill. So when you're on a 50 to an 80 year hold, mm-hmm. You want to be very cautious about where you're putting your money. And if you think, you know, Glasgow and Edinburgh are going to be very strictly regulated markets in the next, you know, 10 to 15 years at least, and Bristol and Manchester aren't, you're going to be in Bristol, Manchester, rather than Glasgow and Edinburgh, regardless of what the fundamentals say.
So one of the elements of that there is we need properties built. I understand, from a political perspective, I do understand those landlords, and I saw on the Scottish Government's website there was a freedom of information request. Somebody had asked about what percentage of private landlords registered are owners of just one rented property, and I'd always thought it was about 70%. The Scottish Government came back and said from landlord registration, 95% of private landlords only rent out one property. And that then, I can understand from a political perspective, if you at least appreciate the private rented sector is going to be need to be part of the solution, why you wouldn't be comfortable with the solution coming to people who, greatest respect, that's people doing it as a hobby. They're not doing that as a living. So I understand why you want to not have that. But it looks to me as if they are using the stick effect to get rid of those landlords, but they've got no carrot effect to bring in the replacements. Is that, what carrots would you have? What tools would you use if you're wanting to do that? If you want to reduce that 95% down, because you don't think that's healthy, but you appreciate that the private rented sector's got to be part of the solution, what carrots and sticks would you use?
Yeah, I mean, for the funds, it's political certainty is a massive thing. And getting the funds, the institutional funds, into residential in the wider UK has been quite a hard slog, mm-hmm. You know, for consultants like myself have been trying to advise on it for the best part of 10 years or 12 years. It's been quite a hard slog because they're quite comfortable where they are. You know, they're in retail or they're in commercial and they're in student. You know, so student accommodation has been a very strong new market for a number of these funds over the last, say, 15, 20 years, you know, particularly with the expansion of, with student numbers after the Blair reforms. But trying to get their head around, you know, more standard residential has been difficult because they don't think about it in the same way. They think, you know, that I can make a yield of 6% on commercial and yet you're telling me that it's only going to be 4 or 5 on residential. Why am I going to do residential rather than commercial? And you say, well, because it diversifies your portfolio. Commercial is going to run into headwinds, as it has done. Mm-hmm. You know, look at what's happened to the office market. PBSA will inevitably run into headwinds because student numbers will end up declining at some point. Overseas student numbers are dropping on the latest statistics. Yep. And retail is running into headwinds, as we're seeing. You know, it's no longer as, you know, profitable to put all your money in a big shopping centre because people's shopping habits have changed. Mm-hmm. So residential should provide you with that diversification and look at the demand supply imbalance in residential, which we've just talked about. You know, you don't have that same imbalance into the other market. So a number of the big funds, you know, the likes of L&G, have more than dipped their toes into the BTR market. They've gone full whack at it, and they have invested quite heavily around the UK, including in Glasgow and the LNG scheme just south of the river, Solasta scheme. That was the fastest letting LNG scheme in the country. So they're very pleased with how it's performed, and they would love to do more in Scotland. But they can't do more because you can't really price the asset when you don't know what your rent revenue is going to be.
Mm-hmm.
And if you can't adjust your rents to deal with an environment of increasing costs, then again, you're going to be in a bit of trouble. Now, L&G tend to have a de facto rent control anyway. They tend to operate under inflation or 5%, you know, whichever is lower. But the problem for your pension fund is you've got to be beating inflation or at least be inflation-linked, you know, index-linked.
Yeah.
If you're not doing that, then you won't be able to afford your pension liabilities when they come down the line. And if you can't guarantee that while operating in a country or investing in a country, you won't invest in it. And at the moment, because of the uncertainty around what the measures are going to be, and it's not to say that rent controls can't work, you know, well implemented, well thought through rent controls work in places like Denmark, but they don't tend to work in places like Sweden, different type of rent control. And they didn't work in Finland. So Finland had its rent control experiment. It caused a collapse in supply and they rescinded it. And now the PRS sector is beginning to respond.
I think politicians would sometimes just need a wee reminding because we're all busy people that when we talk about that institutional investment and pension funds, these people have a responsibility to their pensioners and to their future pensioners, most of whom are our neighbours or ourselves and certainly part of the voting public as well. But it does seem to me that if you want to pursue the laudable aim of rent controls, but you also understand there is a housing crisis and that the supply and demand in the rental market and the availability an opportunity of investment for these institutional funds. There's a way of doing both.
Yeah.
Because you just need to look at a different way of supporting that institutional investment, either through the use of land, or a capital incentive or capital subsidy. So you can protect tenants from abuse by rogue landlords, because that's frankly what the aspiration of many politicians is to do. And I've been a politician with a big mailbag, as it was in those days, of how some landlords, which are a vast minority, of course, you understand the pressure that comes on politicians and how their view can be skewed of the market, but you can do it with it in a different way. What does it mean? There must be a role for the Scottish National Investment Bank to help square the circle. My own view is that this matter around rent controls and all that will not be resolved before the Holyrood election in 2026, leading to greater uncertainty in that element of the private sector market. I hope I'm wrong, but I just feel that's, I also think that the idea that you would allow this to be done on a local authority, by local authority basis, is a recipe in a small country like Scotland for great anxiety. But anyway, that's me, I suppose, starting to express myself. Can I ask another question, just because I'm conscious that time is moving on. How much do you think, this is just my take, and if I'm wrong, one of you shoot me down, there's an east-west imbalance in the housing market in lots of ways, isn't there? And one of them has been the growth of private for sale development around the coronation of Edinburgh, which have been, you know, huge and significant and not replicated in the West Coast. It seems to be, as I say, but stats and evidence might prove me wrong. How much do you think that imbalance of such private sector growth, which the cynical people, many of them politicians, say to me, is because those small number of volume house builders that now dominate the market are only chasing where the maximum profitability is? We also know there are other issues about, you know, the view of politicians and planning authorities in the West and certain, you know, so it's not as straightforward as that. But how much do you think that imbalance is now skewing issues like the supply and demand that is so obvious around the private rental market in Glasgow, for example?
Or am I off on a tangent that's misguided? No, I don't think you are at all, Stephen. So the attraction of Edinburgh in the hinterland market, and you have to consider these all housing markets, I think, in a much wider regional context, because the Glasgow market serves the hinterland. It's not just Glasgow city itself. It's, you know, big parts of North Lanarkshire and South Lanarkshire and East Renfrewshire and East Dumbartonshire and, you know, that whole kind of Clyde Plan area. You know, that really, that whole greater Glasgow really is a kind of a housing market. You know, and people will consider, for one type of housing or another, you know, moving to different locations as depending on affordability and availability drivers. And it's much the same in Edinburgh, you know, so Edinburgh is, it's a growth market. The population has been moving there. So the population has been gradually moving east over the last, you know, 20, 30 years. And that's what's been creating the increased demand for housing there. But the Edinburgh market is also served by Lothians and by Fife. And you can see the growth that's happening, not just in Edinburgh, because increasingly it's difficult to build within the city. Mm-hmm. And the Green Belt restriction is quite a tough restriction in Edinburgh. But you're now beginning to see sites that were zoned years ago for other uses, like International Business Gateway. You know, Drum's now behind that, and it wants a residential-led development, which I think has gone in for planning. And that will be 7,000 houses, you know, to West Edinburgh. And the Murray Estate land also, that's been released, and that'll be another 1,500 houses or something. So you're beginning to see Edinburgh move out to the west, but Edinburgh's very constrained because you've got, you've got the Firth of Forth, you know, in the north of the city. You've got the Pentland Hills in the south of the city, so you can't start building there. And then in the east, you're going to start coalescing with East Lothian villages like Musselburgh and stuff. So the only place you can build in Edinburgh really is out to the west. Or what the builders have been doing is been going into markets that have been, are that close to Edinburgh, which you can still commute to. So Midlothian has been very popular. Planning authority there has been, you know, quite straightforward to deal with. And Midlothian has also been one of those local authorities that welcome growth. East Lothian as well, also to an extent. And Fife, you know, particularly the southern part of Fife. So, you know, markets like Dunfermline have grown very quickly, over the last 5 to 6 years and servicing the, you know, servicing Edinburgh conurbation. But you've also got that in Glasgow, maybe not quite to the same extent, but you've had parts of North Lanarkshire, you know, where you've been growing, you know, Gartcosh, Glenboy, along that kind of, you know, motorway corridor into the city. There's been a considerable number of development. And then the M73, M74 also opened up, you know, the likes of Blantyre, Cambuslang, Hamilton. So again, you've had growth in those poles, you know, associated with the city. There is an issue, though, also about affordability, though, within those markets. So whereas in Edinburgh, you've got Average house prices on new built properties probably around about £350 a square foot on average. You know, so you've got plenty of room for manoeuvre as a developer, and it's probably more profitable. And then you've got land value extraction as well. You've got developer contributions to make. You've got 35% now affordable housing to make. So a lot will come off that land value, but you've got more headroom to work with it. In some parts of the West, you may be down at £270-280 a square foot in terms of sales value. So the headroom that you have, you know, in terms of viability is much less. And then when you get to the likes of Argyll and Bute, which is another place that's called a housing emergency, you know, developers would build in parts of Argyll and Bute, but it's just that the house values there, they're not going to be much above £230-240 a square foot in terms of sales. And by the time you take account of the increase in costs and the cost of getting the workforce there and infrastructure issues, you know, if you've got to build new access roads and things in order to be able to get to the site, that means that many of these, you know, kind of rural areas just outside your main conurbations, you know, can't be built out on. And, you know, Argyll and Bute, they've had development in Helensburgh in recent years, but not really many other parts of it.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the issue.
I suppose I'm conscious of time as well, so I need to wrap this up. What I'm hearing is there needs to be a lot more hard work done by government and local government to get it right. And I'm not saying what that is, but there just needs to be more work done, either legislative, financial, planning, whatever. There needs to be a lot more input of knowing that housing is important. I always get back to, I wish I could remember the stats now. I remember doing the stats 10 years ago in a job that I was in about how much £1 spent in the construction industry added to GDP. I'm sure it was something like £2.64 for every pound in construction was added to GDP. And again, it was similar in terms of how many full-time jobs each house generated, because it was a knock-on effect. And I always remember looking at those stats and thinking, you can see why post-war, the first thing they did was build lots and lots of houses, because it just transforms the economy. And then you look at it now and think, so that would be the obvious solution for government to transform an economy. And I suppose that's maybe why housing is getting a lot more talked about UK-wide. Because if you want to transform an economy, build houses.
Absolutely, yeah. The multiplier effects are very high. You know, if you've just mentioned, Brian, an economic impact can be quite very significant. You know, 6% of GDP is just in construction. But yeah, I mean, you talked about a more collaborative approach between private and public sector. That's something that we kind of wholeheartedly support. We've been trying to get there, and don't mean to embarrass Stephen, but you know, that whole kind of Team Glasgow approach that you had, you know, a number of years back, where there was that kind of collaboration. And not just the kind of collaboration, but then the ability to translate it into an action plan, you know, to take things forward. And we've seen a lot of the benefits of that still coming through. You know, you can see the transformation regeneration areas, for example, in Glasgow. You know, a lot of that was kicked off around that time. And, you know, you look at the likes of Lauderston and Pollock Shaws, my old stamping ground from years ago, you know, you can see just how the regeneration activity and public-private sector collaboration, because that's what it is in these areas, has East End of Glasgow, look at the improvements there that you've seen. That's all been done by, you know, those sectors working effectively together, not just to see the problems, but to find solutions to the problems.
Spot on. I have to say, having listened to all you've said, John, selfishly, I'm glad I'm not in politics anymore, trying to grapple with all these issues. But in my previous life, we knew you in our little core team as the John Curtis of the property industry. And I hope that my successors and people in other political worlds will listen to much of what you've said as keenly as they listen to John Curtis. Hey, and it's evidence-based as well.
Yeah, very well said. Yeah, thank you.
Okay. Thanks very much, John. That's been magic. Thank you.
Thank you, guys. Cheers.
Thanks for listening to the Scottish Housing Podcast with Stephen Bissell and me, Brian Gilmore. To ensure you don't miss an episode, please follow us and subscribe wherever you pick up your podcasts. To find out more about the presenters, go to scottishhousingpod.com, and to get all the latest information about forthcoming guests and new episodes, follow us on social media at Scottish Housing Pod.